This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We are all tired of crying for the dead. This is Genoa, Italy, a town in Italy that is split by a river that runs through the center of town, and it's a port city, sort of like Portland. You know, we're bifurcated, split in two by the Willamette River, runs through the center of town, and then of course we're separated from Washington State and from Vancouver, Washington, by the Columbia River to the north of town. But Genoa, Italy, only has one river. It runs right through the center of town. And there's one bridge that crosses that river, at least one major bridge that crosses that river. And the Italian government, some years ago, privatized their roads and their bridges in response to the demand of the European Union that, you know, hey, neoliberalism, it's a wonderful thing. You got to privatize all these government functions so that some company someplace, some billionaire someplace, can make money off your public utilities, your public services. This kind of following on my conversation in the last hour with our conservative caller who was asking, at what point is education really part of the commons? I think we can all, even if we disagree on, you know, the threshold for defining education as part of the commons, we can all agree that public roads are part of the commons, or at least should be part of the commons. Maybe we can't all agree on that, actually. Mike Pence privatized the roads in Indiana, you know, the Indiana Tollway. It was done in Ohio, too. It's been done in a number of states. In Chicago, the mayor before him, privatized the parking meters. And so, you know, we've got this, all across America, you've got this trend toward privatization, but it didn't start here. It's been going on for some time all around the world. So Italy brought in this company. And let me get to that and just say, I just want to read to you. This is from the New York Times. Just the first couple paragraphs of the article. Dateline Genoa, Italy. All day Wednesday, outside the austere building that houses Genoa's morgue, parents, children, friends, and colleagues of possible victims of a collapsed bridge entered, dreading what they may find. William Ben Lulu, 42, owner of a French moving company, arrived in the morning a day after the city's Morandi Bridge collapsed, leaving at least 39 people dead. His daughter, scrutinizing images on social media, spotted the wreckage of one of his trucks in the rubble. Two of his workers had been in the truck, moving furniture from France to Italy, but he didn't know if they had survived. I tried to call him, he said, but I couldn't reach him. An hour later, Mr. Lulu had a partial answer. He identified the body of one worker, a man with a wife and three children. Then he went to the police, with the police to the hospital, in hopes that the other man was alive. He says, they say my other worker may be in intensive care. So that's the part of the story that you see in our media. That's the part of the story that you see on NBC, CBS, ABC, MSNBC, CNN. A bridge collapsed in Italy and 39 people died. And there's footage of it, so it's pretty gruesome. The part that they're not focusing on is that this bridge had been privatized. It was being run by a private for-profit company. This from The Guardian. The Guardian's doing a really good job of reporting on this, like they typically do a really good job of reporting on these dimensions of pretty much every news story, whereas the corporate media, privatization, no, we're not going to talk about that. This is Lorenzo Tondo writing from Italy for The Guardian. Furious ministers from Italy's coalition government have rounded on the company. Rounded is a Britishism for, you know, beat up the company that manages the country's motorways, as authorities struggle to quell growing anger in Italy over the bridge collapse in Genoa on Tuesday that killed 39 people. A vast span of the Morandi Bridge caved in during a heavy rainstorm, sending about 35 cars and several trucks plunging 150 feet to the railroad tracks below. And here is where it gets real interesting, and this is the part you're not hearing in the American press. The tragedy has focused anger on the structural problems that have dogged the decades-old Morandi Bridge and on Autostrade per Italia, the company in charge of operating and maintaining swaths of the country's motorways. The row escalated on Wednesday afternoon to include Benetton, the controlling shareholder in Alantia, the infrastructure group that owns Autostrade per Italia. So you got the company that owns the bridge, Autostrade per Italia. They're taking a profit, right? They're skimming money off the top. And then they are owned by a controlling by the company Atlantia, which is skimming their money off the top. And Atlantia's controlling shareholder is Benetton. And of course, they're skimming money off the top. So you've got three levels of corporation skimming money out of Italy's roads and bridges and giving that money to shareholders and wealthy donors and wealthy investors. And what's left for maintenance? What's left for bridge repair? What's left for safety, for finding out if this bridge is going to kill somebody? Not so much. Now, Matteo Salvini, who is the far-right interior minister, who is all in favor of privatization, the hard right in Italy, they love their corporations. He's blaming it on the EU. He's saying that the EU said you've got to do austerity. If you can't, with austerity, what that means is tax cuts for rich people, tax cuts for big corporations, increase profits for corporations, and don't spend money on the commons. Don't spend money on social needs, on the needs of the people. So he comes out and he says this is the problem. He says if external constraints prevent us from spending to have safe roads and schools, then it really calls into question whether it makes sense to follow these rules. And yeah, you could argue that the European Union is directly responsible for this because they're the ones who were pushing for austerity, and the logical, the logical endpoint of austerity is privatization. In fact, that's the most common consequence of austerity is privatization, and that's why the billionaires who are promoting austerity, that's why they're doing it, because they want to be the stockholders in the new company that owns the roads and bridges. Hey, a new investment, a new way to make money. Our old investments are only returning 1% and 2%. If you can get three layers of corporate, greed out there just on one bridge, think how much money you can make on pretty much anything. And then another Italian minister said, instead of investing money for maintenance, this is Benetton, this is the company that owns the company, divide the profits, and that is why the bridge falls. So you've got the right-winger saying, oh, it's all the EU. You've got the left-winger saying, no, it's the company. Meanwhile, Corriere della Sera, and I'm not sure who or what that is, I believe it's an Italian newspaper, but I could be wrong, reported that four other bridges had collapsed in the past 5 years. So when you listen to the Republicans who are out there saying, right up front, we should privatize more of our roads and bridges, like Mike Pence did in Indiana, like John Kasich did in Ohio. We should and privatize and maintain them private. Don't take them public again, like Mike Pence and John Kasich. When they're saying this, this is what it leads to. This is what austerity leads to. Do we really want an America where our infrastructure is merely a profit center for a group of Mitt Romney-style investors? Is that really what we want? I'm very skeptical about that, but, maybe. And again, I think this goes back, most people don't even know what privatization is, why we don't teach this stuff in our schools. When we're teaching government and civics, you would think that we should be telling our kids the difference between, basically a libertarian philosophy of government and a small d democratic philosophy of government, or even a socialist philosophy of government. We're not. We're talking about, dead white guys, the founders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Although I'll tell you, those dead white guys had some thoughts on privatization too, and they were very, very unhappy about the idea. We'll be back. And welcome back. Greg in Davenport, Iowa. Hey, Greg, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV, and thanks for waiting so long on hold. My apologies. What's on your mind?
I am in great despair. I could rattle off 1,000 different kinds of proposals for changes in our American politics, politics of the world, all that, and none of it would make a difference. None of it will save us. You know, I've told myself for quite a while that our hope lies not in our children, but maybe our grandchildren. But I don't see ourselves making it that long. My first concern is for the Earth and what we're doing to it, and how I don't see it stopping until it's just, you know, already, you know, too far gone. I've been thinking, you know, I greatly appreciate today's content, and as usual, I mean, always, it's been content. I've been a listener for a long time, and I appreciate hearing again from Ralph Nader. So I should mention that he's done more and better work just very recently that you might want to, you know, talk a bit about. Mm-hmm. And then Richard Wolff, I followed him for, you know, quite some time. And I just don't see a solution to all that is wrong with the world that lies within politics or with people. But I do have some hope for humanity.
Greg, you're kind of rambling around about, you know, you have despair and things, and the only specific that you've talked about is the destruction of the Earth. I share your concern about the destruction of the Earth, and I share your concern that the history of humanity tends to suggest that we only respond to things when they become crises, and including environmental crises. I mean, you know, the destruction of the by the Sumerian society 7,000 years ago of the land in what is now Iraq, where they, as a result of intensive agriculture and irrigation, that basically salinified, if that's the word, you know, made salty the soil to the point where it could no longer grow crops. In a country that used to be covered with forest and fields is now desert. When you behave that way, and people didn't move away or hunker down until after the desertification started. If you do that on a local basis, you can always move. If you do that on a global basis, you're toast. But I don't see us, I don't believe that we have gone so far that the entire human race is going to go extinct. I think we're looking more at right now at global climate change problems that will probably be destructive to what we call civilization. And I think that there's still time to do something about it. I don't share your despair.
We've already destroyed democracy. The whole corporate conspiracy is, yeah. You know.
I'm not buying it, Greg. I think that there's a good chunk of democracy that's still left. The fact that you and I are having this conversation indicates that. And I'm just not ready to throw my hands up in the air and say, that's it. You know, we're screwed. As long as there's hope, it's worth fighting. And I'm going to keep on fighting. It's coming up on 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a few more things that are in the news, and then we can pick up your phone calls here and anything goes summer. The Senate Democrats have probably wrapped this up by now. This was scheduled for 10 o'clock this morning Eastern time. And they were having a bunch of people come in. This was Debbie Stabenow, who pulled the thing together. She's the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee chairwoman. Debbie Stabenow, Ron Wyden, Tammy Baldwin, Mazie Hirono, Gene Shaheen, and Elizabeth Warren, and Chris Van Hollen, and apparently a few other senators that they were expecting. And they were taking testimony from a variety of people who have pre-existing conditions, who are concerned that the Trump administration is now allowing insurance policies to be sold that specifically exclude you from coverage if you have a pre-existing condition. And, I mean, this is, if you have a pre-existing condition, this is a big deal and a big problem. And, I mean, it's not just the problem of if you buy that insurance policy. Yeah, many people can avoid buying those insurance policies. The problem is low-income people may not be able to avoid buying them, because you're talking about an insurance policy that might cost $100 or $200 a month compared to an Obamacare policy, a good policy, that might cost you $400, $500, $600 a month. but doesn't exclude pre-existing conditions. And so, in a way, this is being foisted upon, being pushed into the realm of low-income people by the Republican Party as a way of destroying Obamacare. Trump has been trying to destroy Obamacare ever since he came into office. By the way, I would add that the Constitution, Article 2 of the Constitution, says specifically, explicitly, that the President of the United States shall see to it that the laws, that in good faith he executes the laws of the United States. It doesn't say, it does not say, the Constitution does not say the President may decide which laws he wants to pass or which laws he wants to enforce and which laws he doesn't. Article 2 explicitly says that the President shall execute the laws of the United States. And, you know, in good faith. In fact, I'm looking for the exact quote. And it may take me a little more than just a minute to find it. So, but, you know, trust me, it's in there. Article 2, Section 2, Article 2 of the Constitution. And so I would argue that Donald Trump trying to destroy Obamacare, Obamacare is the law of the land. It has not been repealed. The Supreme Court, you know, carved a big hole in it for the states that don't want to expand Medicare. Or Medicaid, excuse me, and you know, but Trump by kneecapping this law by saying that we're going to cut the enrollment period from 2 months down to a couple of weeks, by saying we're going to cut hundreds of millions of dollars out of the budget of the people in the federal government and outside of the federal government for that matter, who both publicize the availability of Obamacare and help navigate people through how to sign up for it. You know, defunding those people, this is all stuff that's envisioned in the law. Trump is not fulfilling the law. He is not executing the laws of the United States. And that, in my opinion, is a high crime. He is failing his constitution. He's not just failing his constitutional duty, he's defying his constitutional duty. And now he's rolling out, he's authorizing, the law says that these kinds of insurance policies can only last 90 days. They're envisioned of, you know, you work for an employer that's providing your health insurance, you're moving jobs to another employer, there's a 30, 60, 90-day window during which you have to sign up for health insurance with a new employer, and their insurance company has to approve you, and during that period of time, you don't want to be completely without insurance, so you get this, you know, low-cost, high-risk insurance that basically just covers you if you get hit by a bus. But, you know, doesn't contemplate that you might get diagnosed with cancer, because that's typically not something that happens in the 30 or 60 or 90-day window when you're changing jobs. But now Trump is saying, oh, well, you can buy these policies for up to 3 years. Right. And then at the end of 3 years, what do? You just go from one insurance company to another and buy another one of these three-year policies. I mean, this is more than a scam. This is the President of the United States refusing to carry out the laws that were passed by the House and Senate and signed into law by a previous president, when he cannot get the votes in either the House or the Senate to repeal this law, or at least in the Senate. He cannot get the constitutional legislative process working to take down the Obamacare law. And so it is the law of the land. And this guy Donald Trump has made like a business out of flaunting the law. You know, the Constitution says that the President of the United States cannot enrich himself as a consequence of being the president. He can't take emoluments from other people. In other words, profits. And he still owns and runs the hotel in Washington, D.C., among other places, but that's the big obvious one. The lease that he has, that the Trump company has, with the city of Washington, D.C., says explicitly that no owner shall be an elected official in government, or even an appointed official. I mean, he's in violation of his lease. He's in violation of the Constitution. He doesn't care. He said, oh, my base will support me. I'll just tell them it's fake news. We're already in a constitutional crisis. We already have a lawless president. If Barack Obama had done anything even remotely like this, it would have been the subject of years of congressional hearings, hours of grandstanding. It would be at the top of every news. Drudge would be at the top of the Drudge every day for months. We need to be raising hell about some of this stuff. I mean, this is just so wrong. We'll be back with your calls after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It's the home of the political revolution, the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars. Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking the truth to multinational corporations. We'd really rather you didn't know all about. A couple of quick things in the news, and then we'll pick up your phone calls. Down in Georgia, Stacey Abrams is vying to become that state's first black governor. Maybe the first female black governor in the nation. I believe that that's the case. If she wins, she's the Democrat. She's running against a Republican who I believe is the Secretary of State, the guy in charge of voting, which may have something to do with, why Randolph County. Randolph County is a largely black county in Georgia. 61% of its citizens are African Americans. In some areas, there are large chunks of Randolph County that are 100% African American. And in one of those places, there is a school where almost 100% of the voters are black. They want to close the polling place in that school in Randolph County. Well, gee, it's all black people. We can't have them vote, right? But it gets worse than that. They want to eliminate 75% of all the polling places in Randolph County, basically, presumably, just leaving them in the areas that have some white people in them. The election board is meeting tonight in Randolph County to discuss this, whether they should shut down 75% of their polling places, 7 out of their 9 polling sites, as well as a location at a school where almost 100% of the voters are black. The ACLU is challenging this, but in case you were wondering, Kelly Macias of Daily Kos writes, "This is all possible thanks to the Supreme Court of the United States. In 2013, it eliminated requirements for jurisdictions to receive permission before changing how people can vote. This was provided for under the Voting Rights Act." And Ajit Pai, I was talking about him yesterday and the day before. I've been talking about all week, the guy who runs the FCC, who lied through his teeth about how there was an attack on his website. That's why over 1 million people who wanted to say that they opposed net neutrality were not able to register their comments. Turns out it was no attack on the website. Turns out Ajit Pai lied. Excuse me, he testified before Congress. I'm not sure if it was this morning or if it was yesterday afternoon, but I just got this email from fightforthefuture.org from Evan Greer. And in this email, he says, she says, "Under fire from his Senate colleagues, it's hard to say what Pai did faster, walk or talk or throw his staff under the bus. Today removed any doubt that Ajit Pai will be remembered as one of the worst FCC chairs in U.S. history and that he should resign immediately. When pressed on exactly how long he knew the FCC's alleged cyber attack was fake, Pai shrugged and said his hands were tied. Chairman Pai's bogus claim that the sky has not fallen since net neutrality was repealed is at best naive and at worst intentionally misleading. With a vote to overturn the repeal passed in the Senate and pending in the House and 23 attorneys general suing the FCC over it, internet service providers like Comcast and AT&T are not going to restructure the entire internet while the heat is on." So, yeah. You know, it doesn't look all that different right now. Well, it's not all that different right now because these companies are waiting to see what shakes out. And they don't want to tell us in advance how it's going to look until, you know, all these efforts to stop, you know, to destroy net neutrality are either successful or not. So, anyhow, that's what's going on. Picking up your calls, Regina in Chicago. Hey, Regina, what's on your mind today?
You pick different levels.
Regina? Regina, you've been on hold for a long time. I'll come back to you in a minute. She's on line 5, Shira. Jackie in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Jackie, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I wanted to talk about what we now have is inelasticity on workers' wages.
Mm-hmm.
And the economists are talking about productivity gains doesn't increase the wages anymore. And supply and demand doesn't increase workers' wages anymore. And I don't know if they're serious about this or not, but they're saying they're scratching their head. Why is this happening? And theory they come out with is monopsonies, where 2, 3, 4 very large corporations control almost every segment of our economy, and just like they control the price they pay for goods by strong arm tactics, and they control the price of goods they sell and drive small independents out of business by controlling what price they sell. They're now able to control the cost of their labor, because if you work for, let's say, a pharmaceutical manufacturing firm, and there's only two of them in the country, and you don't like the wages you're getting paid, what are you going to do?
Well, in addition to this, Jackie, one of the things that these companies are doing, and this is ubiquitous, or at least it was a few years ago, in the fast food industry, which is bizarre, you know, because somebody who works at McDonald's making hamburgers doesn't have access to the kind of trade secrets that a scientist at a pharmaceutical company would have. But they have these non-compete agreements that say that, you know, if you quit McDonald's, you can't go to work for Burger King or Arby's. You can't. You're forbidden by contract. And so that, you know, redefines the whole labor market. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. The biggest piece of this, though, is that workers have been disempowered. And a large part of that comes out of the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that employers can enforce these contracts, they can enforce binding arbitration, and most importantly, the U.S. Supreme Court has, in over 20 decisions over the last 70 years, taken an absolute meat axe to the power of unions, to the ability of people to unionize and form a union to protect their interests. And this has all been funded by right-wing billionaires, by the way.
I would say also though the size of these huge corporations is a problem. If we want to get workers' wages to rise again, we got to break up the monopsony.
I absolutely agree. And we also need to raise the tax rates so that companies will have an incentive to put money into their workers' pockets rather than just their executives. I'm totally with you, Jackie. Well said. Thank you very much. Let's try Regina again in Chicago. Hey, Regina, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for allowing me. We got through.
Sure. It's all good.
Great show. Great show today. Last time I called in, I was the woman in Chicago running around saving plastic bags so I wouldn't have to pay 7 cents a bag every time I went to the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
So the theme of a lot of what you have been saying today is corporate greed,
yep.
Which is what you gave me that explanation the time before you were here when the unions brought you in to speak, because I kept asking, why do they keep doing this? And the day is, let's face it, the Republican Party, because they're the ones trying to play around with dictatorship and authoritarian thought and all that sort of stuff. And everything that everybody has said today, the young man that called in earlier talking about the food and what can we do, if Renetta talking about disabilities and things mm-hmm. like that, it's all got to do with the trick of control of the masses of people. Now, I'm not trying to sound, you know, hocus pocusy and stuff like that, but that's really what it boils down to. What you just said over what's going on over in Italy,
mm-hmm.
it's privatization. And I think our food distribution should be part of the commons. I mean, you know, we can't have people... Look, Monsanto wouldn't have gotten the grip that they did using Roundup if the companies were willing to pay workers like they used to do to go in the fields and pull the weeds up. Then we would have a decent product to distribute to people. I'm not against innovation and things like this and making food grow faster in certain aspects, but you can't go around spraying every field that grows food in America with a product like Monsanto and expect people to survive. I have so many friends that are dying of cancer. It is frightening.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my kids was engaged to somebody who, I believe, died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, you know, he was a gardener. I don't know if there is a relationship there or not, but now I'm looking back on it going, hmm.
You'll be doing home all day long.
You know?
So, look, I agree with you totally, Tom, when we're trying to explain to people, and I do it all day long, you know, when I'm talking to people, because everything is political. And if you're walking around thinking that it isn't, and if you're walking around thinking, oh, my vote doesn't matter, hey, wake up.
Yeah.
Everything is political, and we have got to get our democracy back,
yep.
Basically.
Yeah.
And quit running around being such a fickle nation and stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. I would argue that the reason why Monsanto was able to dominate the industry the way it did was, number one, they were huge. When George Herbert Walker Bush was president, that's when the GMOs had reached the point where they could be brought to market. and there were no laws or rules that regulated them. So Monsanto went to Bush, President Bush at that time, the first President Bush, and said, we want regulations on GMOs. And they wanted those regulations to, and they, in fact, they wrote those regulations, or a large chunk of them, or advised the writing of them, so that it would be really difficult for any company that was smaller than Monsanto to bring these kind of products to the marketplace. So there's an example of companies using regulation to lock competitors out of the marketplace, number one.
Oh, sure.
Number two, they've been buying science for years, and it looks like the science has been fake science, and we've been victims of Monsanto the same way we were victims of the tobacco industries if this lawsuit that Bobby Kennedy just won holds up under appeal. And I think the world is waking up to this. So there's multiple structural things at work here, but spot on. You've really identified it, Regina, and it is corporate greed. I mean, that's the bottom line for all of this.
That's it. And corporate control. There's a reason why they're trying to tamper with our vote, so that it's not fair. That's the only way they know they can be in control.
Yep. Yeah, well, and this started with the Powell memo in 1972, or 71, whatever year it was, in which he was saying Ralph Nader and Rachel Carson are threatening the survival of business in America. Rachel Carson was, her campaign was to stop DDT. Silent Spring was a book about how the birds, their eggshells don't form properly when they're exposed to DDT, and one day there would be a spring with no birds, no baby birds. And she was right, by the way. And which led to these laws against DDT, which led Lewis Powell to say, and then Ralph Nader was doing the same thing with cars, with unsafe at any speed, Lewis Powell to say, we've got to fight back because, we've got to make our profits. It doesn't matter if we kill people or kill the environment. We've got to make our profits.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
That led to the Cato Institute and to the Heritage Foundation and to the Federalist Society and all this stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I got to move along. But Regina, thank you. Spot on. Eric in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just was wondering, off of this earlier discussion of the Omeros recording of Trump and General Kelly, what generally is your position on people who take it upon themselves to do stealth recordings in those kind of environments? Are you pro batch recordings?
In some states, it is legal for one party to know that the recording is happening and not for the other state, or the other party. And in other states, you have to have both parties. In Washington, D.C., you only have to have one party. That said, some of these recordings were done inside the White House in areas where it's explicitly forbidden. I don't know, Eric, if it is forbidden by law or if it's forbidden by policy, whether it's something you get fired for or something you go to jail for. And I suspect that we're all going to find out fairly soon. But my take on all of this is that if Omarosa or anybody else for that matter broke the law, that they should respond to that law, that there should be a penalty for that. If she did not break the law, if what she did falls within the purview of First Amendment protected speech and all that kind of thing, more power to her. I just don't know the answer to the question yet, and I guarantee you there's some very good lawyers who are trying to figure it out. We'll be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Summer here on the Tom Hartman. Tomorrow will be Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman program. Stick around. It is coming up on, it's a little after 47 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more on the Tom Hartman program. And welcome back. Ricky in Roseville, California. Hey, Ricky, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
So my topic is housing. So I just recently, just a little backstory, just recently moved from the Seattle area down to the Sacramento area. I grew up in Sacramento, moved to the Seattle area when I was 19. From 19 to age 30, I lived there, and it was impossible for me to make it on my own. I had jobs that paid me over $20 an hour, but I could never afford a one-bedroom apartment. And I was right in this like income bracket where I made too much to have any, like, to qualify for low income, yet I made too little to afford my own place.
Right.
So kind of housing is my topic. And then also I wanted to piggyback that onto, you had two callers ago, you had the guy was talking about wages. And what I will say is that I've worked for several, you know, national corporations, and I definitely see that, you know, nobody's getting paid wages that they deserve. And also there's must be a corporate philosophy of promote people who are ineffective yet toe the company line, because I work really hard, yet it's so hard for me to get promoted within these companies. And I see people around me getting promoted and they're just really quiet. They don't do much. They're just kind of at their desk working. And, they just kind of toe that company line, you know. Anyway,
what's your point or your question, Ricky?
So kind of my question is, what is the end game I just don't understand the end game of the housing crisis. Like, now that I moved back to California, you know, I'm working in the tech industry, and I make decent enough money to where I feel that I should at least be able to afford a one bedroom apartment. And I can't.
Well, let me take a shot at this in the minute and 20 seconds I got left. Number one, supply and demand. To the extent that the supply of housing is easily and widely available, the price of housing goes down replacement cost plus a modest profit. That's not what's happening in San Francisco and Seattle right now, and much of America, but particularly in those cities, in part because city zoning is making it, and the whole NIMBY thing, not in my backyard, lots and lots of neighborhoods that could be, that are single-family homes that could easily accommodate a couple of apartment complexes are refusing to allow them. They don't want more housing because, you know, hey, it doesn't look good, that kind of thing. Or those people will come into our neighborhood, lower income people, people of color, whatever it may be. So you've got that, number one. Number two, also further increasing the shortage of housing on the West Coast in particular is the fact that the United States has no laws against foreign people owning U.S. real estate. Now, there are several countries that have just in the last few years started passing such laws. New Zealand is one. They just did it 2 weeks ago. They said no more foreign owners of New Zealand property. Why? Because so many Chinese were buying New Zealand property that it was jacking New Zealand property up to the point where New Zealanders could not afford to buy their own property. This is what's happening on the West Coast.
That's happening here in the Sacramento Valley.
That's right.
It's
money from China, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea. You're absolutely right. So, you know, we need to address these at a systemic level. We need to increase the amount of housing stock, which means taking head on some of our cherished zoning laws, and we need to make it so that you can't just buy investment properties in the United States and turn them into rental properties and hold it as a bolt hole for, you know, when the Chinese government goes south. Ricky, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our program in Vancouver, Canada. Alan, watching us on YouTube. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yes, good morning. I hope I can get this all out.
Okay.
I agree with you that the Dems have a poor slogan. What is it?
A better deal.
A better deal?
Yeah.
Yeah, I left three words with your call screener. Hope he passes them on to you. I don't want them broadcast to the Republicans.
Okay.
Something has to be done.
I'll ask her when we get off the air.
I sent those three words to Friends of Bernie by letter and also Mark Pocan.
Yeah.
Got no answer from Bernie's people. I didn't really expect, but Mark Pocan's only had a chance about a week. I don't know what else to say. I know you don't like to call this fellow Spanky. I don't even like to say his name, but
yeah.
I've come up with a new... can't think of the word.
Alan, I ask you a question? How do you think that most of your fellow Canadians view Donald Trump?
Oh, my God.
How is he characterized in your media? You've got CBC News there as the largest news supplier in the country, isn't it? The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation?
It's a government-run or subsidized.
Yeah. Right, yeah. It's like NPR here or CBP, or PBB. Corporation for Public Broadcasting. How is Trump characterized in that media?
Actually, I don't watch much of my own news. I watch you for 3 hours.
Watch American News.
MSNBC.
Yeah.
But I just like to end with a bit of humor.
Okay.
You don't like to call him Spanky, so I call him the present White House occupant.
Right. That's a good one.
Which is also known as P-Who.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Alan, thank you for the call. Larry in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Hey, thanks for taking the call. Hey, quick question. You just, you know, I'm a guy that has a, you know, I've probably employed, you know, a lot of people became self-employed back in 1990. And so, you know, it's a small business in Seattle area, Tacoma. And, you know, you mentioned back to the medical, you know, the health insurance with Obamacare. For me to insure one of my guys, you're talking about $500 a month for one of my guys.
I know,
with
same here.
The programs that are available. So you were saying that pre-existing condition, that whole thing, like, oh my God, it's so bad. But Tom, look, if you're under the age of 30, like my kid works for me, he's 25 years old, okay? I would have to pay $500 to $600 a month to insure him. He's got no problems. Why can't he have a major medical plan, you know, like we used to have?
Because it blows a hole in the side of Obamacare. If you don't have young, healthy people paying into a system that is being used by older, unhealthy people, then the older, unhealthy people are going to have to pay so much that you don't have a system anymore.
You've never ran a small business then, my friend, because there's no way...
Larry, you don't know what you're talking about. The simple reality, it's like saying, you know, only people who are retired should have to pay into Social Security. That's essentially what you're saying, Larry. And frankly, respectfully, it's stupid. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating day. I've been saying that a lot lately, but it has been. I mean, it's an amazing time to be alive with everything that's going on. I got to track down what Omarosa's tape was. I'm guessing we'll be talking about that tomorrow. And continue with more of the news of the day. Tomorrow will be Anything Goes Friday, so you know whatever's on your schedule, whatever you'd like to discuss, give us a shout. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy doesn't just happen by itself. It's not some magical thing that, you know, Thomas Jefferson dropped on our heads. It requires you. Every one of us have to get active all the time. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.